Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Erica Weitz, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. On the air, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Monday at 1 o'clock on HeritageRadioNetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. On today's show, I'm joined by two women from very different sides of the industry, not to mention the country. They're both hugely influential, and they're both named Amanda. In the first segment, I'll be talking to Amanda Clute, is how you say your last name, right? The editor-in-chief of Eater.com. And in the second segment, I'll be talking to Amanda Chantal Bacon, right. Okay, I just had the two names in my head. The founder and owner of Moon Juice, based in Los Angeles. Amanda Kay, we're going to start with you. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Show. This being the show that brings the pages of a magazine dedicated to women in food to life, I wanted to jump right in with a post you wrote very recently on Eater, which was, I think the title was Casual Sexism in Restaurants. For anyone who might not have read it, do you mind repeating the story that inspired the post?
Yeah, sure. So on Eater now, we have these forums where you can basically put out any topic of conversation and hope people will discuss it with you. So it's a little more casual than how we used to have everything where it was like article. So this format allowed me to post this question to my audience, which was about sexism when you're getting the bill, when you're being asked what you want to eat. The specific story here was that I was at a restaurant having a breakfast meeting with one of my staffers. He's a male editor. And when they brought the bill, they put it right in front of him. And it just irked me. And it's happened a ton to me. And it's not just about where they place the bill. It's also the assumptions waiters often make when you're ordering at a bar or at a restaurant, like, oh, did you want that without the bacon? Or maybe that's a little alcoholic. Do you want something lighter and fritzier?
Like women drink whiskey too.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not the biggest case of gender discrimination in the restaurant industry. It's not the biggest of deals to have to deal with, but it's one of those little daily things that you experience where
you're like, those things add up.
Yeah, it adds up. And it's also one of those things that could be easy to fix. Like if they just had a staff meeting with the waiters being like, oh, reminder, put the check in a neutral place because some people are sensitive about that.
I'm a big believer in like small things sort of adding up to a really big change. I was curious about this post for a lot of reasons. And one was the sort of new format that you were describing and how it's a forum and the way at the end of the post you asked your readers if they had had similar experiences and what their thoughts were just about the whole thing. First, how would you describe Eater readers?
Very passionate about the restaurant industry, very involved. It's a lot of people who work in the industry, but really most of our readers are just people who are obsessed with restaurants. So they work 9-to-5 jobs and they go out at night. So they're very informed, involved, super engaged. So
they're filling the seats.
I mean, I wasn't surprised that people responded immediately. And the first responses were pretty much like, yeah, I've seen this all the time, like in telling their stories. And then by the second day, there was the backlash of people who were like, this is stupid that you're even talking about this. This is disgusting. You're reading too much into it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I'm curious about that backlash. And I was thinking about, I guess, I don't know exactly how long ago, but maybe a month or two ago, Amanda Cohen from Dirt Candy, who writes for Eater and who writes wonderful pieces, in my opinion, for Eater, was on the show. And she was talking about when she writes her pieces, she's always worried about her mother reading the comment section. So I wanted to know your thoughts on the comment section in general and that sort of backlash moment. And what do comments mean to you?
Our comments have evolved over time. When I first started in 2008, it was just a free-for-all. and we tried limiting anonymous comments, and it basically stopped all commenting. So back then, we were like, okay, you know what, this isn't fun anymore, and it's not very bloggy, and we really want it to be bloggy. There needs to be a comment section, there needs to be a discussion going on. But as time went on, and as we got more serious, and as we had more people join our staff, it became an issue where I would have some women applying for jobs being like, I can't do this job because I don't want people attacking me in the comments. Some of your readers are incredibly sexist, and the only way to really monitor them is to have to read all of them and go and delete, 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 and then read it again to make sure it got deleted. And it became too much of a burden on us.
That's
and
I felt a full-time job. Yeah.
Yeah. I felt irresponsible. I felt like I couldn't recruit some of the people I wanted to recruit because there was this very real problem. So I think it was about a year ago we put registered comments on the site.
So what does that mean?
It means you have to be registered.
Okay.
So before, some people registered and most people didn't, and now you have to register. You can make up a name, but it has to link to some sort of email. There's a way that we can trace you.
So it sort of keeps people accountable.
Yeah.
Even if it's not.
Exactly.
If they're putting out a new.
So like if you really want to write something disgusting, you have to take the extra step to sign up
yeah.
and like go through the thing and then write your disgusting thing, and then
yeah.
we'll find it and delete it.
And I think even just making people, besides like it being linked to an email, like you're making people pause before they write something.
Right,
so
right.
They're really thinking about it if they want
to
say something
yes,
awful.
They have to try really hard. Yeah. Also, now we have a person whose job it is to be our community manager. So he manages forums, he manages
awesome.
Comments, he's in charge of deleting comments when they're out of line, and can also ban commenters or give people warnings. There's a whole system in place where like you get a letter saying how you messed up mm-hmm. and the guideline that you went against, and then after that you get banned.
When you so it's someone's full-time job to really oversee
yes.
all this. So when that person, when something happens and they are forced to kind of send that letter mm-hmm. that you have in place, what usually happens after that? Do people kind of sort of
people
relax
often,
or
often relax?
Yeah. I think that's so interesting.
I mean, you always have trolls who will like just create new names and go through all the process, but it's rare.
Yeah.
And it's like if they want to try really hard, then it's this guy's job to chase them down, and it
yeah.
gives him something to do. So,
yeah.
okay.
So as editor in chief of Eater, you oversee a large, it's a national site that's sort of a big umbrella, and you have 24 separate cities
mm-hmm.
that have sites. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you publish all different kinds of content, everything from, you guys are doing restaurant reviews, there's long form essays,
mm-hmm.
there's gossip, there's a bit of everything.
It's
a lot of moving parts.
It's a lot.
Yeah. What's your typical day?
I don't really have a typical day, but it's a lot of moving parts. So there are a lot of people to keep track of. My hope is that everyone is overseeing their little section of Eater to the best of their abilities. And if they're doing that, there's not a lot I have to do. I just have to check in and make sure everyone's doing their job and think about our future and think about who we're hiring next. Talk to people in the video department about what videos we want to do next. Talk to the sales team to make sure they have on hand everything that we're doing so they can sell against it. But that's not always going to be the case. There's always going to be turnover. There are going to be people who check in and want my feedback on whether a feature is a good idea or if they cross the line somehow. So it's a lot of putting out of little fires and then thinking about the big picture.
Yeah. And how would you define the big picture for Eater?
I mean, I think Eater right now is poised to become even bigger. We were acquired last year, and it gave us a lot of firepower in terms of hiring and in terms of our ambition. So,
and you've made some pretty excellent hires.
Yeah. So we've added, like you said, restaurant criticism. We've added long form features. We're really trying to grow our video department. And I think we want to be the really important, influential food brand for the next 10 years. Everyone used to know Gourmet back in the day, and you know, those of us who knew it still love it. But we want to be that household name. Like, oh, if you want to know about food, Eater is the place to go. If you want to know about restaurants, it's Eater.
And is that because, like, as we were talking about all the different kinds of things that you publish, including like sort of really, you know, things with like a lot of, I guess you would say like pith, and then
mm-hmm.
a lot of really sort of like gossipy,
yeah,
lighter
yeah.
news. Is there any? How do you decide what to include, or do you just include everything? Is it?
We want everything to have an angle and a voice, and it has to have an Eater quality to it, which means it should be a little unexpected. We are one of the few people, I think, that allow ourselves to have fun out there. Like, this is a really silly industry. It can be serious at times, but it's like, we should be able to have fun. It's food. So we can be bizarre and wacky and absurdist. But
there's
also
a sense of humor.
That's one of the overriding things. But in terms of content, we really want to be able to tackle all kinds of stuff. Like, we have a section of the site called Eater IDK, where we just cover the stupidest crap out there, like Dunkin' Donuts new whatever croissant donut thing, or whatever Pizza Hut is doing, or this guy who ate 1,000 hamburgers and had a heart attack. And then we, on the other end of the spectrum, we have some amazing heartbreaking feature that, you know, you bookmark and you'll read it over the weekend and it's just gorgeous and you'll cry. So it's trying to...
So it's sort of a catch-all for
everything.
Yeah. I'm curious about your experience running this very large show with so many moving parts, as we said. I'm curious about your experience specifically as a woman in the driver's seat of this operation. I was wondering, do you experience anything in your work life sort of similar to what you described earlier, the post about, you know, the check being given to the wrong person at the table?
Well, in the media world in general, I think we're lucky in the food space because it is pretty balanced. Like, you see a lot of really powerful women and a lot of powerful men. So I think that's nice. In terms of my own company, I think it was actually a big bonus for them. My company, it started out as a sports site, a tech site, and a video game site. And they acquired a food site, Eater, a real estate site, and a shopping site. So they basically brought in a ton of women into their space because they were running these male-focused verticals. And it just ends up being a very male-dominated office. And now it's full of women. And I think... And they've said this to me, that I think we really brought some balance to the place. And I think, I don't think my gender has anything to do with why I'm the editor-in-chief, but I think it is a bonus for my bosses to be able to say, like, one of our seven verticals is run by a woman.
So you're the only female editor-in-chief of...
Now our shopping site has a female editor-in-chief. So it's two out of the seven sites.
Got it.
But yeah, I think men and women do deal with things differently. Like, now that I'm used to being around so many men in powerful positions, you see how, you know, ego does come into play and they can be more aggressive and they can, you know, they do want to hear themselves speak. And that's a generalization, but I think it's, you do have to think about it, be like, okay, I need to step up to this. I need to...
Yeah, what's your response? Like, when you're in that, I don't know, a conference room at that moment and you're with a bunch of, you're the only woman in the room, everyone's really in love with what they're saying, and what the objective for what you need to get done might not be getting done. What do you do in that moment? What's your response?
I mean, I think I'm still figuring it out. Yeah. I think it's hard for me because I'm also not someone who's really enjoyed the spotlight. Mm-hmm. I just like doing this job. So I get the things done that I need to get done, and I push through the measures I need to push through, but it's usually not in a very loud way. But I have learned that, you know, if you're in the conference room and you're the only woman, you need to speak up. You need to make sure that you're bringing ideas, even if you'd rather just send them in an email to somebody.
Sure. Yeah. It's been a little bit of a running theme on the show that part of the gender disparity in the food industry comes down to money, asking for it, securing it, being offered it, maintaining it. I read and I loved your response to the question about the best professional advice you've been given. I think this was maybe on Refinery 29. Mm-hmm. And you said, don't be afraid to talk about money and always ask for what you want, not what you think your company is willing to give you, whether it's a raise or a promotion or a change in your responsibilities. I just thought that was great. And I wanted to get very practical here and ask you how you would advise someone, especially a woman, to ask for money. How would you like, if someone was coming to you asking for a raise, what is your dream scenario of how they would phrase that?
Sure. Yeah. This happens to me all the time. And sometimes I actually have to check myself because I'll be hiring someone and they'll ask for an exorbitant amount of money. And I'll say, no, we don't have that much money. And they'll come back with like a slightly lower, still exorbitant amount. And I get annoyed because I'm like, I can't believe they're asking for this. Maybe we're not even on the same page. But then I realize, you know what? Like, this is what they're supposed to do. This is part of negotiation. They are asking for what they think they deserve. It's your job to tell them what you can give them. And it's not personal. You can't read too much into it. It's just money. So I think it's good to remember that. As I have to remember it. And I think it's good for applicants and for employees to remember it. Like, this is just money. No one's going to think of you as this selfish person or this money grubbing person. Like, this is something everybody has to do. It's every man for himself. So I offered every man and woman for themselves. I offered a raise recently to an employee, and it was a really big raise, and they asked for more. And at first I'm like rolling my eyes, like, why can't you just say thank you? But then I said to her, I was like, you know what? No, but I appreciate you asking. You should always ask, because maybe I had an extra 5,000 that I was holding on to that I was, you know, I could give if someone just asked for it.
No, I think it's interesting to talk to you about this, because I think you've gotten into this really wonderful mm-hmm. position, and you're also in the position to help other people get into position.
Right.
So you're sort of on both sides of the question. And I know, I think I'm a big believer you're never going to get anything that you don't ask for. Like, how are people supposed to know?
Right, exactly. And sometimes it can get hard, because some people will come to me and be like, hey, I've done the research. I think I deserve X. And I have to say, I can't give you X, and I'm sorry, and let's move on from here and work together and, like, not have this in the back of our minds going forward. But I think it can be difficult.
Yeah. But good to bring up,
yeah,
for sure. There's been, as you were saying, a lot of new stuff going on at Eater. I know you guys redesigned the whole mm-hmm. site recently. There's new editors, as you were discussing, new restaurant critics. What does the future look like for Eater?
Well, this year has been a big year of expansion. So I'm hoping the next year will be a year where we really grow into ourselves and settle down. We have a lot of new employees, so making sure everybody, you know, just gets used to what they're doing, gets better at what they're doing. In terms of expanding further, I would love us to go international mm-hmm. at some point. I think London has an incredible food scene that's really, I think it deserves an Eater. I think there is a lot of media out there, but I don't think anyone's obsessing over the openings and closings and the drama in the restaurant scene that there should be. It's a gossipy town. Everyone reads like 3 papers a day.
Yeah.
There are 9
best
restaurant
tabloids.
Critics. It's so it's like the perfect city for Eater. Yeah. So I would love to go there. And, you know, like I mentioned video a couple times, I really want to build out our video department. I think we can do some really fun things there. But beyond that, I think we really just need to settle into ourselves.
Awesome. And what about you? What's the future for you as Eater grows into all these different?
I don't know. I mean, yeah. I'm really lucky that I enjoy my job so much. I've met so many people who don't, so I just don't take that for granted at all.
Awesome. Oh, it's great to hear, and it's refreshing. In much lighter news, mm-hmm. we have a few minutes left in this segment for the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A.
Exciting.
So it's the 7 questions I ask everyone who comes on. No pressure, no worries. I purposely don't send them to you before, so it's whatever first comes to mind. So Amanda, number 1, sweet or salty?
Sweet.
What did you have for breakfast today?
I had green juice and a latte.
That's a perfect segue to mm-hmm. the second segment.
Like, I almost knew that I was going to be on with Moon Juice.
Did you buy that? Did you make it?
I bought it. I'm not evolved enough yet to have a really big blender and keep myself in produce, but I have started purchasing green juice elsewhere.
Awesome. Number 3, if I looked into your refrigerator right now, what might I be surprised to find?
Well, actually, that's a funny story. I got married 2 years ago, and probably will be the last wedding present arrived on Friday.
Oh.
And it was from a friend of mine who's a Virginian, and she sent me an Edwards ham.
Awesome.
Which I notice you have an Edwards ham. So it's this country ham. It's this whole leg. And my husband and I unwrapped it, and we're like, what the hell do we do with this thing? So we had a party Sunday night. We ate a lot of it, but we wrapped the rest up.
There's
and
still more.
It's in the fridge, and it will be there for months.
The
and
whole
months.
Leg.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what a possibility of what you could do with it, which is my wife is from Virginia and is obsessed with country hams.
There we go.
We could join forces.
Just wrap it up and give it to her.
Number 4, what's your go-to snack?
My go-to snack. I'll say popcorn.
Mm, good one. What's your favorite time of day?
Probably 3 o'clock.
P.M.
not A.M.
Where do you want to travel to next?
Ooh, I know where I am traveling next. I'm going to go to Mexico City Christmas. I went there once, and it's just so much fun, and
work
I want to go back
pleasure.
Just for fun.
Yeah, that's great. And the last question, number 7, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Oh, man. I guess chicken and dumplings my mom used to make,
that
but not
delicious.
The southern kind, like the Eastern European kind.
That sounds really good. So like the kind of like rolled out.
Yeah, cut. Like doughy, yeah. And then like just weird chicken parts.
Awesome. Amanda, thanks so much for taking time
Thank
out of a work day
me.
To come on.
This yeah, is so fun.
It's been a pleasure. I feel like I have so many more questions I could ask you, but
next time.
Yeah, for sure. And listeners can read your work and all of the work that you edit and produce at eater.com. And your personal Twitter handle is just your last name, Klut, K-L-U-D-T.
Yep, right? That's it.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reggie Watts, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian, and I am back with my second Amanda of the day, Amanda Chantal Bacon, who started and runs Moon Juice, which is, as you were saying before, more than just juice.
More than just the juice, yes.
You sell certified organic juices, moon milks, cosmic provisions, tonics, and lifestyle tools. Is that right?
It
that
is
include
right,
all
yeah.
of the above. At 3 locations in Los Angeles and online as well. I'm sure you hear it all of the time, but what a last name you have.
I know. It got me a lot of jobs when I was in fine dining.
I feel like the irony makes you just destined to do what you do. I love that someone last name with Bacon is running one of the best juice places in the country. I just think it's perfect. Your professional background started not in LA, but in Vermont. Is that right?
It did. Yeah, I guess officially Vermont.
Yeah.
And I dabbled all over the world. But
What were you doing in Vermont?
I went to culinary school in Vermont. I was on the brink of opening a hotel in Uruguay.
Oh,
in
wow.
Jose Ignacio. And that didn't pan out at the last minute. And I thought, okay, why don't I just go back to square one and figure out how to properly cut an onion before I attempt to open a hotel with a restaurant. And
that sounds pretty
that.
Smart.
Yeah. So I went, you know, to figure out how to chop an onion.
That's
professionally.
Great. I was talking on a very recent show with Jasmine Rodriguez, who runs Hot Bread Kitchen, and she was talking about when she had the idea to start a Hot Bread Kitchen. Her idea was really solid, and then she realized she didn't quite know how to bake. And so her first step was to really apprentice and really learn how to bake and go to square one. So I think that seems to be kind of like a defining trait of a lot of women on the show, of really getting the information they need to do whatever it is they want to do.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of that is actually how to wash dishes
yeah.
really well.
Yeah. Don't
Henry
waste
Ford
any time.
style is really what's valuable.
How? Describe that.
God, I think probably the thing that made me most valuable or got my foot in the door was, one, my last name was Bacon, but two, I could get down with some dishes.
Yeah.
And I could get down with, like, cleaning yeah. a grease trap.
But describe the Henry Ford style.
Oh, everything. Everything needs to be Henry Ford. When I walk into a kitchen, when I wake up in the morning, it's like game on, beginning, middle, and end. You know, it's a way of thinking.
Yeah. I think it's sort of, it sounds like making, like, knowing that everything has like actionable ways to get it done.
Absolutely. And that there's a method to everything, and there's a place for everything. There's a landing zone to everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got, you know, like one specific job that they're doing.
I love that. So post culinary school, you went to Los Angeles, right? And you worked in
I did.
Some professional kitchens.
I
and
did.
Then How did you end up at, you were at the Los Angeles Times Magazine, is that right?
Yes.
So how did you make that transition?
Well, I worked with Suzanne Goen. Mm-hmm.
He's an icon.
Oh, yeah. And the best mentor you could have. And she was in the kitchen every day that I was there. So I was there, and a woman named Laura Zerubin was moving out to Los Angeles to start the new LA Times Magazine, which is sort of fashioned after T Magazine, mm-hmm. and there was a big budget, and there were really incredible people involved with that. So she came and ate at the restaurant. She had been an old friend from New York that knew my family, and she had a great career. She wrote a book and had a restaurant and had worked with House and Garden. So she tapped me on the shoulder for this job,
awesome.
and I jumped.
And then you went from there to opening Moon Juice, or was there a step in between?
I was doing a lot of cooking in between. I opened a restaurant with someone, and that didn't pan out.
Yeah. Lessons learned.
Lessons learned. I don't have a partner in Moon Juice. There was cooking. There was cooking and, like, pregnancy and restaurant opening and all of that before the doors opened.
Wow. Would you say that, because it seems to me like that experience you had at the LA Times Magazine was sort of like a little bit of an exception to a career that sounds like is mostly sort of in kitchens and mm-hmm. opening stores. How has that served you?
I think the way it served me most, really, I mean, it was terribly exciting, and there were these huge budgets to do these stories that I wanted to do on ranches and about sea urchins and, like, going out with fishermen, and it really was my dream come true, and there was travel involved and meeting all the interesting people that I wanted to, and I wrote a lot growing up, so it was kind of this wonderful moment of getting to put two of my passions together. But what it really showed me was that I love having my hands in food, on food. I love running around all over the place. And having board meetings didn't work out so well for me. And then having to answer to advertisers really didn't work out so well for me. So where it started off as a fantasy, and, you know, I'm sure like any good publication goes, you need to start including stories and you need to start interviewing certain people. And that didn't work for me so well. I think I was also in a different place in my life and feeling really idealistic.
It sounds like with Moon Juice, you made the thing that does work for you very much.
I love
the description in the latest, the third issue of Cherry Bomb, the one with Ruth Reichel on the cover. You said that Moon Juice is as much about pleasure as it is about healing. I love that description. Could you explain that a little bit more? What does that mean to you?
I mean, I think that sort of sums Moon Juice up in a brief sentence. And the goal with it is that from walking in and looking around and talking to the people behind the counter and putting anything in that shop in your mouth and putting it in your hands, all of that should be extremely pleasurable and at the same time really healing. Mm-hmm. And merging those two worlds. I often talk about Moon Juice being the merging of fine dining with freaky health. and, you know, and it's also pleasure and healing. And I think that a lot of people are feeling that these days.
But, like, desire for that? Or?
Yeah, just encapsulating both of those experiences in 24 hours. I think it's quite common. I'm sure Amanda could sum it up, that you go out and have a great meal and a terrible hangover, and you wake up and go have a green juice, and that green juice should be delightful and pleasurable and healing, mm-hmm. and the room that you're drinking it in should also be pleasurable, and the person handing it to you should be as pleasurable as the waitress mm-hmm. was the night before who poured your wine.
Yeah, so no sort of punishment or guilt or anything like that.
No.
Yeah, I think that's so wonderful. I think I agree with you. I mean, hopefully all of life is as positive as the experience of going into one of your shops. Speaking of Moon Juice and how it's run, in that same story, you said that it's run like a fine dining restaurant. Mm-hmm. Tell us about a typical day for Moon Juice. How and when does the produce come through the door? How long until it ends up in the bottle? What else is happening sort of behind the scenes, behind the counter?
We get daily deliveries of produce. And
where's the produce coming from?
The produce comes from this really lovely company. sorry.
No, that's all right.
It's a boutique purveyor. They only deal with organic produce, and they're one of two companies in Los Angeles doing it, and they're a little more expensive, but I love working with them. They're family run. They source almost all of their produce from California and are working directly with a lot of farms.
That's wonderful.
Except for, you know, bananas and pineapples and cucumbers in the winter. And they deliver daily. It's prepped. It's put into little prep boxes, and it's juiced that night. Very late into the night, into the dawn, it's put on a truck and brought to the stores.
So where does the prep and the juicing happen? Is it not at the stores?
It all happens in a commissary where our offices are. So,
and is that where your typical day exists? Because your shops are in, you've got one in Venice, one on sort of the far west side of Los Angeles, and then one in Silver Lake on the far east side of Los Angeles. Did I get
one downtown? You got it.
I am. Okay. I get confused. I get my north, south, east, and west all over the place. So the commissary kitchen is located where?
Culver City.
Culver City. Okay. So kind of like in between all this stuff. So is your, in a typical day, are you at every location or?
Sorry.
Yeah. Can we get you anything?
Coughing and hacking, bad advertisement.
We need to get you a juice, right? What would you suggest for a cough?
The coughing and hacking. Ginger. I've been doing ginger all week.
Okay. We will try to source some. Yes. Take your time. Yeah, no worries.
God, I wish there was a typical day.
Yeah.
I go so macro and micro. Throughout the day, I'm in the kitchen futzing with, you know, quinoa sprinkles to macro and talking to hotel groups and how we can get healthy food in their hotels. So I'm just like a tornado.
Yeah.
My schedule changes middle of the day.
What is a quinoa sprinkle?
God, my favorite thing. They're on our little raw sprouted donuts, and it's raw and sprouted quinoa. That is dehydrated with turmeric juice for our little yellow sprinkles and raspberry juice for our pink sprinkles.
Huh. Are they sweet at all or just sort of a moment of crunch?
Kind of like a moment of fantasy and crunch.
I love that. That sounds great. Do you sell those on their own? Is that?
No, but that's smart.
Yeah.
God, why don't I do that for your vegan ice cream sundae?
Right? I think that sounds great. Let me see. Okay, so that. And then speaking of the sort of quinoa sprinkle and coming up with a new idea, how often are you coming up with new juices and recipes?
Every day.
Yeah.
I don't sleep at night. I'm like, you know, visioning crazy desserts and juices and milks and tonics. And, you know, I think that's probably why my team loves me and hates me. So, you know, I often feel like a stampede of wild horses, you know, that like perhaps my skin and my bones are like the rodeo gate to keep all of the wildness inside. But, you know, when we have a really good positive meeting and it seems like everything is smooth for a minute, that's like the moment where I get to bust out with, you know, the 19 ideas that I've been sitting on for the last 6 months.
Yeah. And then how does development happen after that? So you have the idea, you present it to your team, and then how does it eventually end up in a bottle or a jar?
It's my total fantasy. It's, you know, it's like we have this huge, raw, organic, crazy, biodynamic lab back there, and we'll sit in meetings and I'll throw the idea out. I've got an incredible team that we kind of have a formula where, you know, if we're talking about a cookie and I can reference a certain type of dough. So we really are building, when I say crisp, they know what that means. And I can say this time, let's do a crisp, but let's make it a fermented crisp and with green nettles and spring onion and double spicy jalapeno. And there's a language, and I know what that means. And, you know, I have to go off to work in the world, and I come back 24 hours later, and overnight, you know, one of the geniuses in the kitchen has done something up, and they've made four different samples. Yeah, and the great thing about working in kitchens for so long and reading so many cookbooks is that I can actually, I can look at a recipe and taste a sample and then go back and say, this needs to be 1.5 teaspoons, not 3. Bump this up to 1.5 pounds of daikon, not 3/4 of a pound. And usually it's spot on.
Yeah.
And then we'll go back and do a second tasting, sometimes a third and a fourth. And if we can't get it, then I'll hop in and do it myself or do it at home.
It sounds like all that experience you had working in kitchens has really served everything that you're doing.
Yes, I'm like a little calculator.
That's so funny. We have to put you in our pockets. Everything that you sell ranges from what I think of as kind of sort of the familiar, for example, really great fresh almond milk, your date shakes, the vanilla fig shake. And then there's also things that are a bit more unusual, especially in your apothecary section. I picked one from the website, the Blue Water Alchemy Liquid Ormus, is that how you pronounce it? Which is described as a liquid suspension of semi-precious metals and monoatomic elements in a high spin state. And it's made from Peruvian and Bolivian salts. Where do you find this? How do you discover it? How do you vet these items? Do you work with a chemist or a doctor? Or I'm so curious about where sort of that section of moon juice develops.
That's my favorite section of moon juice. That the apothecary and the apothecary moves into a lot of our edible items. And that's very much the way moon juice is moving, is that I feel like my desires and my minds and the things that I'm always vetting out in the kitchen and testing is like, how do we get ormus into frosting and make that a cupcake that's low glycemic and delicious? So I feel like what's available is always 3 steps behind where I'm really pushing and going. So that is my favorite part of moon juice, and that is like the freaky, hidden, secret alchemist side, which is very much, I think, the two poles that I'm trying to bring together are the freaky, secret, hidden, maybe imaginary alchemists living in the cave, and Roberta's for pizza.
And so in terms of finding the ormus and the freaky hidden alchemist,
sometimes
like, is that an actual cave? Like, where, where does it all come from? How do you find it?
Sometimes they find me and sometimes I find them.
Interesting.
oftentimes these sources are several years of relationships where it's like a friend of a friend, and this guy knows this alchemist that's making that. And
I guess it's like any industry, and
it is
a lot of word of mouth. And,
and some of them come from doctors, and how I do vet them out is I try so many things. And I feel like my body's really, really sensitive. So I definitely, if we're going to present something, whether it's an ormus or a shilajit or a pearl powder, I've tried everything that's available on the market, come up with what I think is best, and then vet that out with different doctors we have helping us, whether they're an Ayurvedic doctor or a kinesiologist, but really trusted sources.
That's great. And I think, I mean, especially because you're introducing all this to an audience who really, you know, a lot of them are probably discovering it for the first time through you, and it's very exciting. Do all those doctors that you consult with, is it like, do you have a board, or are they, how does that all work?
Yeah, I mean, one day I'll make it that official, and we'll take nice pictures of them and present them to everyone. Yeah. No, that's actually a hope and dream of mine, that we can bring these incredible minds and doctors to the forefront and have them write blogs for us or make them available for people wanting more private consultation with them. But at this point, you know, they're my personal doctors, and I've worked with them for years.
That's great. And when you're introducing all of these items to your customers, I'm curious, because I know it comes up a lot at shops here in New York. What's your response to customers, and I imagine this is mostly new customers, who are surprised or even uncomfortable with the price of some of the products?
Yeah, you know, it's incredible. We don't even have those people anymore. And maybe what's even more incredible is that Moon Juice is on the less expensive end, having a $9 juice, which, you know, the year before opening, I would like stand in front of the mirror and be terrified and do my practice speech of like why this organic cold press green juice had to cost $9 mm-hmm. and would want to like cry during that speech. And, you know, I was definitely going out of business. I would have to drink all the juice at the end of the day.
So you get into the popsicle business.
Yeah, right. Because there really weren't any juice shops open back then.
Which wasn't that long ago.
No, it really wasn't. No, this whole thing has just blown up. So there's not a lot of defending that I have to do right now. There's still some, and I'm really excited for that moment when I get to walk into a shop and really talk to someone. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, it's surprising the person that will raise an eyebrow at the price of a $9 organic non-HPP green juice is somebody that has on a $3,000 bag. It's never the guy that's, you know, on his bicycle, not driving a car in Los Angeles, who's like super stoked to pay $12 for the walnut milk that has Mucuna in it. It's that woman with that handbag in the car that, and so that's a great moment, because that's a moment when I can really sit and talk with someone and try to help readjust how they're experiencing it.
It's an informative moment, and you get to explain
it's what do you choose to invest in? Because I know that that person is investing in their car. I can see it outside the window, and they're investing in their handbag. And I don't knock those things. That's fun. But, you know, maybe think about investing in your body.
It's like
and
the gasoline health. That's going into that, you know,
Bentley. Totally. Put it in your mouth.
Oh, that's too funny. Okay, on that note, we're going to go right into the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A.
Okay.
Which you had a little preview with.
I know,
with
and I've
Amanda.
Forgotten. I got very nervous. Okay,
no,
here we go.
I'm glad you forgot, so it'll all be just whatever in the moment. Number one, sweet or salty?
Oh, I want to say salty, but it's sweet.
It can be both. It can be and. Number two, what did you have for breakfast today?
I had a green juice, and I had a lot of raw chocolate.
How much is a lot?
Oh, God, like a bowl. My mom and I made raw chocolate this morning and put it in the freezer for like a quick set, and then I ate the whole thing.
That sounds great. If I were to look into your refrigerator right now, and this could be for you, your refrigerator at home or at Moon Juice or maybe your mom's if you're here in New York for a bit, what might I be surprised to find?
At home, I'm doing these crazy vegan sprouted nut cheese experiments. So I'm aging all of these different nut cheeses to see how they hold up, because I'd like to have like Moon Juice vintage macadamia nut cheeses. So I've got cheeses in there that are more than a year old that have like, you know, crazy scribbles on it and dates and samples.
That's so funny. I feel like you need like a white lab coat in your home kitchen.
I have one.
What's your go-to snack?
My go-to snack is the sprouted Dulce almonds that we do at Moon Juice. It's apple cider, Dulce and vinegar almonds.
So like a lot of like a umami moment.
Yeah, with mushroom powder on there too.
Wow, that sounds good. What's your favorite time of day?
Probably 10 a.m. when all my power drinks are really hitting my
Kicking
system.
Where do you want to travel to next?
Bali.
Ooh, good
Dying
choice.
To go see the cacao farms out there.
That would be cool. Bring a film crew.
Yes. I'm actually trying to work that angle. That. Yeah. Who will sponsor my trip?
We could maybe talk to Eater. My last question. What was your favorite meal when you were growing up?
My favorite meal growing up was steamed artichoke and like a big jar of mustard too much vinegar, too much garlic vinaigrette that I would like literally drink that jar.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
I'm of the sort of mustard vinegar camp. Amanda, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks.
And thanks for taking time out of your trip to New York to come to Bushwick. Listeners can find Moon Juice online at moonjuiceshop.com. Is
yes.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same for both your Twitter and Instagram work handles, Moon
yeah.
Juice Shop. And as always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Monday at 1 o'clock for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.